Doesn't that computer know who you
are? Don't they have any idea?
Bow down to the Tech Talk host.
That's right. That's right.
Behold the glory that is
a little while ago, I was installing some software, and I ran across this exact same
thing. I find you pompous, judgmental, and completely self-absorbed. Would you be my
onto
friend?
A Windows Vista machine.
You would think.
You'd think there'd be no problem.
How could there be a problem with that?
I'd say in a given week, I probably only do about 15 minutes of real, actual work.
Directory permissions with config.msi directory, blah, 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 blah. This is Tech Talk. Good morning. This is Tech Talk on WRLR 98.3 LPFM in Round Lake Heights, Illinois. Hey, we've got a great, great show for you today. I'm excited about this one. This is going to be cool. We've got not only our regular Jay Garman, who we're going to bring on in just a couple of minutes. He's going to give us some geek trivia. Now, he's remote today, so we're doing a little cell phone action. That's all right. We'll get that worked out. And not only that, but of course, after that, we're going to have at the end of the show our cool sites of the week, the podcast only song of the week, and then in between all of that great stuff, we've got Alexander Montague. That's M-O-N-T-A-G-U if you're looking for him online. He is an intellectual property lawyer. He's written a great book that breaks down what intellectual property is, what it means to us today, and the kind of things that we should be concerned about and thinking about, especially if you're involved in any of the technical fields, which kind of, I mean, really, there's nothing that doesn't use intellectual property anymore. I don't know about you. I of course, work in computers and technology, and so you run into it a lot and use that phrase, you know, the IP. You always hear about IP and IP stuff. He's going to break it down and tell us exactly what it is, exactly what we've been seeing in the news with it lately, and the ways that we need to think about it. I think it's great. I've read a great part of his book, and we're going to talk about that when he comes on as well, and I can tell you, it's a lot more fascinating and interesting and intricate than you may even realize. So that's going to be great. He's going to be on in just a couple of minutes with us. Like I said, after we bring on our good friend Jay Garman. Before that, though, there are a couple of kind of big deal news stories that have been going on this week as well that I want to just touch on before we get into our regular stuff. One thing you might have heard, now there's a lot, now and of course, I know we're post-election here. We're in a post-election world, so I'm going to make no political statement about that. I am going to say, though, I'm excited and happy that the election is over because this means hopefully all of our Facebook timelines and Twitter timelines and everything else that we use for receiving information and connecting with our friends will clear of all of the extremist political messages from the left and the right and the in-between that we've been getting for the last 6 months in some cases. That excites me to no end. I'm really thrilled to get back to just talking about cute cats and and everybody's baby pictures, which if you had asked me that 6 months ago, I would have said, no, you're crazy. I don't want to see any more of that. But I can tell you a couple of baby pics now. That sounds pretty good to me. That sounds pretty good to me after this campaign. now going from our politicians and then talking about some of our heroes, seven Navy SEALs were recently charged and punished. Why? Not for problems in the field. No, they got home and they decided that they would help Electronic Arts, EA, make a new game called Medal of Honor Warfighter. So the EA hired them. They hired these seven active. Now, this is the thing. They're active but retired U.S. Navy SEALs to help in the creation of Medal of Honor. But the Navy was really, really displeased and felt that their participation in this was in direct violation of Article 92. Article 92, if you're not in the Navy or not a SEAL, you probably won't know what it is. I didn't. It means that members of the Navy SEALs cannot disclose classified material, period. End of story, to anyone. Even if it is for a really, really cool game that's coming out. So the seven SEALs are facing punishment. They're probably going to lose some of their privileges, possibly even pay. Now, they And they've all received letters of reprimand, and they've had a cut of their pay in half for 2 months. That may be the extent of the punishments, but we'll see. I don't believe that the actual charges against them or the issues are that serious or deep. I believe if they had really exposed sensitive military information of something that the DOD felt was going to make a difference in our struggles around the world, that the punishment would be a far more severe than what we've seen so far. Now, it could change. That could happen soon, that it would be more severe in the near future. My guess is this is kind of a laying down of the gauntlet, no pun intended, that they've saying, you know, look, we're not going to accept the fact that you're going to talk about your experiences. These experiences are experiences owned by the U.S. military infrastructure, and in so being, you know, you just can't go and start making video games out of it. So that'll be interesting to follow in the coming weeks and see what may or may not happen with that. The other big news that came up here recently that you may not have heard about is that China is really really getting down on Google. They are just Google hating lately. They have blocked access essentially to all of Google's sites and services. They've blocked Google.com, Gmail, Google Plus, Maps, Docs, Analytics, Drive. I mean, but really the whole panoply of Google applications and capabilities and websites and everything. It's all being shut down. Now, you can, if you're a Chinese citizen, get to Google websites via google.co.uk. So there are ways around it. Now, you may be asking, well, why? Why are they shutting this down, and why right now? It turns out right now is the Communist Party of China's 18th Party Congress. This is when they get together and they start deciding how they're going to lead in the coming years, or at least for the coming year, similar to our presidential elections and things like this. This is an important point for them and an important time for them for making those decisions. Now, China has not traditionally, shall we say, encouraged public opinion and public input into the way that they lead. So I think that is really the reason why. There's no word yet, though, whether that will cease when the Congress ends. Once the Congress ends, they may allow access to Google once again, which would be a good thing, I think, all the way around. You know what I'm going to do? I know we're way, way early into the show, but I think I'm going to try to bring our good friend Jay Garman on pretty much right now and see how this will work for us. Now, in the past, we have had occasional difficulties. I don't know if you remember, if you're a regular listener of the show, you may remember we've had some occasional difficulties with trying to bring him on by cell. So hopefully that does not happen here today. And we're giving it a shot right now anyways. And the thing, hey, we even get a ringtone this time. At least that's kind of cool. Now, he did promise. He said this time for sure. He knew he was going to be available.
Hello.
Oh, we did. It worked. Good morning. Good morning, Mr. Garman.
How you doing, sir? We have rolled the Verizon dice and come up seven.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. I think that's actually probably pretty close to the percentages that you get for that, too, is your chances of rolling a seven with two die works out to your chances of getting a good connection with the Verizon cell phone out in your area.
Very true. It's only slightly better than AT&T and Sprint. That's the sad thing.
Oh man, I've got AT&T at my house, and that's wonderful because I can walk from my office to my bedroom and essentially I think transfer between three different towers for that walk, and I don't have that big of a house, so.
Well, my wife is a Sprint consumer, and she can talk on her phone anywhere in the house except the kitchen, because whoever needs to talk on their cell phone in the kitchen?
Oh, yes. Of course. I actually, this is one of my favorite gadgets that I've purchased in my lifetime. Is just a completely utilitarian and useful thing that I have. Is I a while ago, relatively cheaply, picked up a Bluetooth to landline transmitter thing. I don't know what it's called exactly, but basically it uses the Bluetooth on my cell phone. And it plugs directly into my my handsets for my phones in my house, and I have, you know, those remote cordless phones all over the house. So the wonderful thing is I have it in the one area of my house that my phone really works very well and has a good signal, and I just turn it on, and all of the calls into my cell phone I can pick up on any phone in the house, and it's not equivalent to speaking on a landline, but. But at least it, I don't have to carry the phone around with me around the house and lose signal all over.
That is a very useful device. You should put that on your website.
You know, I since you suggested, I will. When I get home today, I'll find the model of it, and I'll even link people to if it still exists to for purchase out to Amazon or your my link of choice to purchase that. It is absolutely a fantastic thing. I use it especially working from home now. I use it constantly. All of my calls come through my cell phone, but I pick it up anywhere I need to.
Excellent. Well, we have one of the, we have a traditional landline because my wife is one of those, we must have a landline. I'm like, why? In case of storms. You realize that this, our landline comes in from our cable company, which means it comes in through the cable modem, mm-hmm. which has an 8-hour battery backup. But if the power's off more than 8 hours, we're as hosed on the, quote, landline as we are on our cell phones. As a matter of fact, I have ways of charging my cell phone, you know, with a crank generator I have or a solar cell that I don't have with the lithium ion buried somewhere in the back of my, you know, cable company issued modem.
Yep. Absolutely. No, my wife and I have the same battle. Now, hers doesn't come down to a fear of storms. My wife, we have an alarm system in our house, which is currently analog line driven, and then we also have the once in a blue moon fax need. And so I haven't quite gotten her over the hump, but we're close. I've almost got her to the point where she's willing to give it up.
Well, with this Bluetooth thing, I think that combined with the ability to transfer our 20 years old now home phone number to, say, a Google Voice number, I might be able to pull this off. I might be able to pull it off and her not know what happened. Really work in my favor.
Yep.
If all the handsets just keep working, she just won't know the difference.
Well, exactly. The only thing with, now there's a couple of different models. I know the model that I got can support up to I think 4 cell phones, and because it's one of those that supports multiple cell phones simultaneously, if you're going to make a phone call out, you have to identify which cell phone you're going to make the call with. So that would be the only thing. Is there'd be a slight learning curve for her as she has to learn to hit, you know, one flash and then the number kind of thing. But yeah, it's I mean, for incoming calls though, there's absolutely no difference at all. No difference at all. And in fact, it can even pull on your cell phone contact list and use that for the caller ID. And you can also use your voice activated calling features as well through some key combination that I've never used, but I know it's possible.
Kind of defeats the point of voice activated calling if you have to enter a prefix code to then do voice activated calling, doesn't it?
Yeah. It's something like, you know, 2###, and then you speak, and then it does its thing, you know. But yeah, if you can also then use your speed dials too. If you go like 2###3, or say, I can't remember exactly what the key code combination is. Like I said, I pretty much never use it, so. I guess if I got real advanced with it, I'd, you know, it's kind of like you mentioned Google Voice. I keep running into issues with Google Voice where I accidentally activate something when I'm making a Google Voice call. So I'll be in the middle of a call and I don't know why, but all of a sudden it'll say, this call is now being recorded. And I believe in my heart, just because of the frequency this happens, that my voice register somehow is right in the number 4 or number 5 on your DTMF tones, and that's triggering these things to happen on the Google Voice line.
Well, you know, the origin of the term, you know, hackers and freakers were guys that could actually, like, sing or whistle musical tones into the old AT&T phone system to make free long-distance calls. Mm. So you're just continuing a proud tradition, albeit accidentally, of hacking the phone system.
I'm a phone savant, a savant freak of sorts, I guess. So I wish it just had something more useful than accidentally recording all of my calls. Would be nice.
Just consider yourself one of the more obscure X-Men. You know, the ones that only appear in like the background in like New Mutants issues. You know, yeah, there's a guy that can shoot lasers out of his eyes. There's a guy that turns to steel. There's a guy that can read any language. There's a guy that can make voice commands on phones, do strange things for no reason. There's a guy with metal claws.
Exactly.
Wait, go back to number 4. What's he doing? And he's tech support at the X Mansion. We don't send him in the field a lot.
That's right. That's right. That's the everyone else's crowd kind of syndrome that we wind up with. I'm one of the crowd X-Men. Oh man. I don't know to be pleased with that or dismayed somehow. But it kind of fits my life, so that's all right. Well, Jay, we should probably move on to the geek trivia stuff, so I can let you get back to your life, since you're doing this remotely for us, which I greatly appreciate. It actually is a very apropos question, because we had a legal question today. As it turns out, later on this morning, I'm going to have another legal expert on talking to us about intellectual property. But our legal question had to do with this recent election and why elections have to occur not just on the first Tuesday of November, but on the first Tuesday after the first Monday of November.
That's right. And like all weird things about U.S. federal elections, it has to do with the Electoral College.
Because wonderful.
Its consequences just go forever when you start going down this rabbit hole. So the regulations surrounding the Electoral College states, and let's remember the original point of the Electoral College was that electors, you didn't elect a president, you elected an elector who would then go to a presidential convention, and they would elect the president. That was the original design. And so the original Electoral College regulation said that after the electors were elected in November, they had to appear at their state assembly halls by the first Wednesday in December, and that trip could not take more than 34 days. Mm. How they arrived at 34 days,
okay,
who knows, but that was the regulation. The problem is, if when Congress originally started looking at setting a national election day of the first Tuesday of November, if the first Tuesday was November 1st, that means the first Wednesday in December would be 36 days after the federal election,
okay,
which would have violated the rules. And they said, let's not change this bizarre, arbitrary 34-day rule. let's write a more arcane way of saying the first Tuesday after the first Monday, so that can't happen.
Yeah, yeah. Now were they giving them like a per diem for their travel? Is that maybe how they came up with the 34 days? That does seem like a very odd thing to derive.
I think the notion was, I don't think it was specifically 34 days. I mean, it was 34 days. It was like a month and 3 days was the original notion. Mm-hmm. The reason Tuesday in general was picked as an election day was because, obviously, in the Iberian society, you didn't want to do anything on the Sabbath because there were a lot of active Christians. And Wednesdays were market days. So if you left on a Monday, you could get anywhere you had to do at your state assembly hall and do your vote, and then you could probably get back for market day on Wednesday. So that was the deal. And electors would have to get from anywhere in their state to basically the electoral central as the state capital or the national capital, which could take a month. So when you're going on horseback and you're going from, let's say, Carbondale, Illinois to you know, the state capital, that's going to be an issue, you know, or wherever you are in West Virginia to Charleston, that's going to be an issue.
Yeah.
You know, and bear in mind, this was written in 1845. Like all good laws that make no sense, we haven't bothered to do anything about it in the last 160-odd years. So.
Well, and why would you, really? I mean, you know, it just it makes so much sense. It's kind of, you know, it's no longer a bug with our electoral process. It's really a feature that we've... we've embraced now. So, oh man. Well, in
it does get into sort of legislative paradox of we've elected all these officials under this bizarre system, but those bizarre officials are the ones who would have to change the system. Do we trust them to make it better?
Good point. Very good point. Yeah. I don't have a lot of trust in our elected officials, period. And yeah, so that kind of goes without saying for me. I don't know. Oh man, and Customer Jones did nail this one. She got her answer in fairly quickly, as a matter of fact, earlier in the week, and then followed up with some additional detail. People that aren't getting these questions and answers and things and want to be part of that conversation can always find us at facebook.com/techtalkwrlr. And of course, there's always lots of Jay and Jay Garman stuff going on at jaygarman.net too. So what should we be thinking about for this coming week?
Well, we're about to pass one of the more obscure and unappreciated anniversaries in NASA history, which was the Gemini 12 mission launched this week in 1966. And what was interesting about Gemini 12 is that they had a very important historical mission objective with Gemini 12. It required a brand new training technique, which is still in use by NASA personnel. So the question is, what was the training technique and what mission objective was it used for?
Oh, that's a great question. I love any of the space stuff. And of course, speaking of space stuff too, I believe it was yesterday was Carl Sagan's birthday. So it's Carl Sagan's birthday weekend. Anyways, we can enjoy and lift a toast to him for the weekend as well.
Absolutely. And as a bonus to the Gemini 12, the crew, the two-man crew, was this obscure guy named Jim Lovell, who you may have seen played by Tom Hanks in Apollo 13, and this other really unknown dude at the time named Buzz Aldrin.
Oh, yes. And they went on to... Went on to be pretty well known following that. So these guys show up quite a bit in any time you look at the history of that time period in our initial forays into space. It's cool stuff. Definitely American heroes through and through.
Yes, anytime I mention Aldrin, I have to encourage anyone to go Google the YouTube video of him punching out a moon hoax conspiracy theorist who keeps saying, "You didn't walk on the moon, you're a liar and a coward." And at one point, Aldrin just got done with him and just called Congress. It is classic.
Which is fantastic. And he was like 75 at the time, too. So it's it's even better. Well, Jay, I'm going to let you go. We'll think about that. Enjoy your weekend. Enjoy your week. I'm going to remind people again, jaygarman.net is a great place to go to find out more about what's going on. And we'll be talking to you next week for sure.
All right. Take it easy, buddy.
All right. Take care. Thanks, Jay.
Bye.
Jay Garman joining us remotely. Did a great job. Thanks. Shouts out, I guess, to Verizon who pulled their weight this time around. You know what? We are going to come back with Alexander Montague in just a moment. I've got to play a quick couple of spots and we'll be back at you talking about intellectual property, talking about DMCA takedowns, all sorts of great stuff. Don't leave us. You're listening to Tech Talk on WRLR, and we'll be back at you in just a minute.
WRLR, 98.3 FM. Superwash is a proud sponsor of programming on WRLR 98.3 FM. Superwash is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and provides automated and do-it-yourself car washes. Superwash services the Lake County and surrounding area, located at 1750 Orchard Lane in Round Lake Beach. For additional information, the phone number is 847-740-2613. Superwash, often imitated, never duplicated. ATC Weggie is a proud sponsor of programming on WRLR. ATC Weggie has been providing accounting and taxation services for businesses and individuals in Lake County since 1960. They continue to provide financial services to businesses and individuals so they can meet their regulatory and tax filing requirements. ATC Weggie is located in downtown Grays Lake. For further information, their website is atcweggie.com and the phone number is 847-223-0777.
If you want to know about the most fantastic networking coalition in town, come to BEST. BEST's goal is to positively impact the Round Lake area youth and families. Our meetings are held the second Thursday of each month at 8:30 a.m. at the Round Lake Beach Cultural and Civic Center, and we'd love to see you. The BEST Hour is broadcast every Thursday from 4 to 5 p.m. right here on 98.3 FM.
You are listening to Tech Talk on WRLR, and we are back. It is time now to give Alexander Montague a call and see if we can get a hold of him and talk about intellectual property.
Alex Montague.
Yeah, good morning, Alex. You're on the Tech Talk show on WRLR. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you very much. It's great being here this morning.
Yeah. I was just trying to do an explanation and description of who you are and your new book, Intellectual Property, Money and Power in a New Era. Maybe you can give just a brief rundown of what you're about.
Sure, absolutely. Well, first of all, I'm an attorney. I'm based in New York City, and my practice is focused on the area of intellectual property, both domestic in the U.S. and internationally. As you mentioned, I've written this book, Intellectual Property, Money and Power in a New Era, and the book is really aimed at, everyday people, business people, anyone who really has a stake in today's economy and wants to learn about how technology is changing the way that we live, the way that we interact with each other, and the way we do business with each other, and how the law of intellectual property has really come to the forefront of our legal system, because it's really that law, that body of law, that's applicable to this new technology.
And I'm gonna let people know too. I've got a copy of the book in my hands, and I can tell you it's a relatively slim book. If you look for it, and I'm talking to the listeners, if you look for it and you find it, you look inside, and I think you're gonna notice two things. One is that it looks a little bit like it's written as a textbook, but I'm gonna tell you, if you actually start reading it, it is really very approachable, very well written. It uses lots of anecdotes and lots of examples to make the concepts clear, and that was one of the reasons I wanted to bring you on. Is when I did take a look through it, I was like, wow, this has got some great information that we can share with people. As you kind of mentioned, regardless of what you do or where you're at, or everything in our life is being impacted by some of these laws these days.
Oh, absolutely. That's because we're not talking about some boring law. We're talking about things that touch all of us today. I mean, just think about it. You walk down in New York City, you walk down the street, and you have all these designer shops that people go into. It's because of the brand. Would anyone ever even go into these shops without the brand? Think about Starbucks. Even online, think about places like Amazon. And that's intellectual property. Mm-hmm. Think about all the software, all the code that underlies computing and the internet. That's all intellectual property. Think about the social media, the smartphone. I could keep going on. Everything is intellectual property.
Well, I guess that begs the question, you know, is there if not a comprehensive, at least a relatively simple definition of intellectual property that we can use to start discussion on it?
Well, I would define it as any intangible that has value.
That is a broad.
As broad as that. And if you think about it, it could be some, you know, it's anywhere, as I said, from computer code and software to shapes and designs. I don't know if you saw, but yesterday, actually, Apple was granted a design patent on the shape of the and the ornamental features of the first iPad.
Yes. Yes.
So, you know, that's intellectual property. You had another very recent example of the color red that was received intellectual property protection in the form of a trademark.
No, I hadn't heard this.
It was a red soled high-heeled ladies' shoe by Laboutin, the French designer Laboutin. And the trademark office had granted a trademark, and Laboutin used that to sue its competitor Yves Saint Laurent. So there you have another example of a color that has tremendous value. I mean, the case made no bones that the shoemaker sells hundreds of millions of dollars of shoes a year based on that color.
And so the color itself was it unique enough and a creative enough expression of the idea of color? I'm trying to get my head around how you can have a color be considered intellectual property.
Well, in this case, the color was functioning as a trademark. It was known, it had come to be known as a Laboutin shoe. A red-soled shoe was known as a and is known as a Laboutin shoe. I mean, this is worn by all the famous actresses, and, you know, if you watch the Oscars, people comment on it. You know, they walk down the red carpet, and, you know, it's the red-soled shoe. It is their signature. It is their trademark.
Ah, so, okay, I was missing one important part of that. So it's actually the sole of the shoe that is colored red, and it's that which is protected now. Oh, interesting.
Yes, so the case actually took some very interesting twists and turns, because initially, and the lawsuit was brought here in New York, in the Southern District of New York, here in a federal court. Initially, the judge, Judge Morero, who's a very respected judge, ruled that, in fact, he disagreed with the trademark office that anyone can have a monopoly over the color red in the world of fashion, because color is used as a form of artistic expression in the world of fashion. And he likened it a little bit to a painting. And he said, you know, imagine if, you know, Picasso had drawn a painting with a color blue and then sued Monet later on, you know, saying he shouldn't use the color blue. He said it's a bit like that. And so he basically invalidated the trademark registration and said that Laboutin did not have any rights in the color red. Mm-hmm. But that decision was overturned on appeal, where the Court of Appeals held that, in fact, the trademark registration was valid. In the end, it was a Pyrrhic victory, because Laboutin lost, because they said that even though the trademark registration was valid, the trademark was for the color red against a black shoe. So this red sole against a black shoe, and the competitor, Yves Saint Laurent, had a shoe that was all red.
Okay.
So here we have an example of just, you know, intellectual property being used really to determine the allocation of money and power in the world of fashion. And it's countless. I mean, you see this everywhere today. I mean, look at the patent wars.
Mm-hmm. Well,
you know, the technology patent wars that are going on. You saw the Apple Samsung case, you know, $1 billion for Apple.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's an interesting segue and connection to make is So we have these situations going on where you've got, as you said, you know, the distribution of money and wealth from these huge companies, and you've got Apple and you've got Samsung and all this, and they're battling and you know, to some of the, you know, us in our more plebeian daily lives, it's like, you know, it's like a battle of titans. But there's also this other thing going on, which you hear a lot about in the technology arena, with these patent trolls. And, you know, I know it's a derogatory term, but it seems to fit so well, because it's individuals who have purchased patents with the sole intent of making money off of them, you know, against these larger organizations. You know, do you consider that a legitimate use of IP, or is that something that's going to be damaging and destructive?
Well, it's really more of a policy question in terms of what we want our system to look like. I mean, it's certainly not the best use of the patent system by any means, and I mean, I don't encourage it, but you have to step back and look and see why it is allowed under existing law to happen. And the reason is that, you know, we have the patent system is designed to reward innovation.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'll give you the reverse example. Imagine that I'm a poor college student and I come up with this great invention and I decide that I'm going to patent this invention. Okay, I go and I get a patent on the invention, and then I go to a big multinational company, and I speak with them, and I said, look, you know, I've got this invention. I don't have the money to actually conceptualize and actualize it and sell it, commercialize it. Would you be interested in working with me to do that? And they say, well, no, thank you very much. We're not interested. And then a year later, he sees his concept being sold on the market.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he uses his patent to bring the lawsuit.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
In that situation, we've got somebody. Is that a patent troll?
Well, certainly no. Certainly no. That wouldn't be, I think, in that case. You know, I think when we hear about patent trolls, we hear more of the situation where, you know, an individual creates an invention, he does whatever, he is able to monetize it and builds a company. Things go along for some time, and then someone else comes along and says, you know what, I'm going to patent one small piece of something that he's using, or I'm going to find a patent for some one tiny part of what's been used here. And then I'm going to use that as a lever to get a lot of money without actually having contributed myself to that innovation process. And I think,
absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that's happening, and it's a bit of an abuse of the system. And it's become a big business. I mean, it's become a huge business. You've got hedge funds that are investing in buying patents and then just launching litigations.
Yes. Yes. Exactly.
That's all they're doing. The point, the example I brought is that, you know, what's allowing the trolls, what's allowing this supposedly abuse to go on, is that the basis of this system is that we want to reward innovation.
Mm-hmm.
And if we are going to allow, if the law is, as it does today, allow people who have made an invention and have patented it but are not actually commercializing it to bring a lawsuit to prevent others from doing so, then that will allow the troll situation to flourish. So mm-hmm. The question is, what do you do to prevent that? I mean, it's a very difficult thing, because if you say to people that unless you're actually commercialized your product, you can't bring a lawsuit, you're going to preclude that poor college student from ever getting anywhere.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I guess this is where things get difficult. You know, to understand or to see the balance sometimes is that there's got to be a line somewhere where, as you say, you know, you want to promote innovation with the law and with the assistance of the legalities that are available to us, but you don't want to at the same time be stifling innovation because ownership of ideas has become, you know, it becomes a situation where you can't build upon the ideas that you would need in order to innovate further.
Yeah, I mean, it's a tight line, and you also have some older patents, you know, that had issued that are now being used, you know, that when today's technology wasn't really in mind, and those are now really being used to disrupt this innovation.
Mm-hmm.
So I agree with you that we're in a system, we've got a system where the law is really trying to play catch-up with the technology. And I think that's really, and if you look at every area, you've got this happening in with copyrights, you've got it happening in the patent area, you've got it happening in the trademark area. And one reason for this is that technology is moving along so fast,
mm-hmm.
and our laws are very old, and our legal system moves very slowly. So you do have these tensions. I mean, you know, you've just pointed that very well in the patent area with the troll situation. We've also got it in the copyright area where we're trying to apply a law that essentially comes down from the Statute of Anne in 1709 to online peer-to-peer publishing, the internet, and the liability of internet service providers like Google and eBay.
Yes, yes. And I think too, you know, one really important issue occurrence that's happening is that a lot of the laws were designed sort of, you know, in situ, that you had this situation where you've got your money is going to be made from a fairly localized environment, and that's completely turned on its head. Now we have this truly global economy, and something that may have copyright protection here in the States would not over in the UK or in China, and in a, you know, I'm losing money, I'm losing my relevance in countries outside of the U.S. because our laws are not global.
You couldn't have put it better. I mean, and you're seeing big stakes, you know, going on in that situation. The perfect example was the Apple case. You know, Apple won in the U.S., Apple lost in Korea, lost in the UK, was required to apologize publicly by the English Court of Appeal. You've seen it with eBay, mm-hmm. where eBay was facing litigation from Tiffany in New York, Tiffany claiming that 75% of merchandise on eBay is counterfeit, and asking eBay to police that, and alternatively asking the court to shut down the eBay website if it continues to sell that, and Tiffany lost, and eBay won. But in France, eBay lost the same case against LVMH, Louis Vuitton. So we do have a real problem here in that the technology that is driving this new force of globalization is being coming up against laws that are very local.
Mm-hmm.
So this is something that's going to have to change eventually. In addition to that, not only are the laws local, but these laws were drafted for a very different type of technology and business. I mean, there's copyright law. As I mentioned, the Statute of Anne was drafted for book publishing.
Yes.
You know, hard copy book publishing. So now that's what we're trying to apply to this new technology.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Not only do we have a system where we've got local laws, but a global technology, we've also got very old laws that we're trying to apply to a very fast-moving and ever-changing technology.
yeah, and I guess that's one of the one of the problems with our system of law and lawmaking is that the focus has tended to be in many cases really on parts of the product, on parts of the media, as opposed to, and the point I'm trying to make probably not very clearly, as opposed to focusing on the idea, on the more ephemeral product itself, which in the case of a book is, you know, the writing. In the case of music is the sound and the content.
Exactly. Exactly right. And, you know, there's only one place, there's only one example I can think of where the law has come close to that. It's very interesting, and that's the law that deals with cyber squatting.
Mm.
And, you know, we've got this online arbitration system. We call it the UDRP. And so if you've got a cyber squatter and you have a trademark and they've got the domain name, they're squatting on the domain name, you're able to file an online proceeding. Okay, so that's already very important. The proceeding is filed online. You don't have to call witnesses. You know, it's not like this hugely slow and burdensome court proceeding.
Yeah.
And it's online and it's global and resolves very fast. I mean, within a month, you can get a decision. Mm. It's unheard of almost in any legal system. I mean, you know, right now in the U.S., which is a relatively fast pace, believe it or not, in the world, the decision sometimes takes 3 to 5 years to come on an average.
Yes, yes. I did not realize, and that is a global system, you say, too. So it does not matter where the cyber squatter resides.
Correct. Correct. That's the key. It doesn't matter where the cyber squatter resides. So if someone registers, alexmontague.com and they're based in Korea, for example, I can file this online arbitration proceeding and I can get a decision. So my point is that for once, you know, we managed to get somewhere by thinking about the specific situation rather than trying to apply these old laws locally to the new technology.
Yep.
Which is really like, you know, pushing a round peg into a square hole.
Yeah.
On the internet.
Yeah, well, and that's what it sounds like here, is that rather than attempting to use the existing trademark laws, to apply to this new cyber domain and technology, it almost sounds like a new structure, new set of laws was created with this in mind as a wholly unique thing.
Yes. Exactly right. Exactly right. And that's, I think, the direction that eventually we will go in. But there are lots of obstacles. I mean, to give you one, even this domain name arbitration is limited because once you get a decision, the cyber squatter can start a court proceeding in his or her country, which would basically stay this decision. It would mean that the decision is not effective until the outcome of the court proceeding.
Mm.
And that's because there are certain things that are written in our laws that make types of global proceedings and online proceedings very difficult. For example, in the U.S., we have this constitutional right of cross-examination. Right? So we have this fundamental belief that whenever you have a dispute with someone, you have to be allowed to cross-examine that person, be face-to-face mm-hmm. with them in court and cross-examine them.
Yep.
It's fundamental. And so if you've got an online proceeding that's fast, that can't happen.
Yep. Now
and again, that concept of cross-examination arose a long time ago, before this technology. And yes, the due process is fantastic, it's very important, but let me tell you, it's not going to be effective when you've got someone across the world and, you know, things are moving at the speed of lightning, when they can register, you know, hundreds of domain names within 10 minutes.
Yes.
You've got a system that takes 3 years to get a decision.
Yeah. Well, and now it's interesting, of course, that we're talking about this and the difference in time frames for accomplishing certain legal actions. But of course, what's been in the news a tremendous amount lately is the speed and sort of arbitrary breadth of takedown with DMCA actions, the Digital Millennial Copyright Act, and how just simply filing a cease and desist order to some of the ISPs can result in tens of thousands of websites being taken down immediately with no due process, with no recourse at all for the person who's being affected.
Yes. You know, the ISPs have come under a lot of pressure from primarily from the music and movie industry. And the way that they're defending themselves is with this notice and takedown. I'll give you an example. Right now, you have a lawsuit by Viacom against YouTube. Google owns YouTube, so it's against Google, but for the YouTube business. And Viacom is claiming that basically the YouTube website should be shut down because of so much piracy. And they're relying on cases like this Grokster case where the Supreme Court agreed and said this Grokster should be shut down because it was created in order to facilitate music piracy. So the way that the website, that YouTube is defending itself, it says, wait a minute, we have a very robust notice of takedown, and that should be enough. And they're relying on that defense. We're going to see what happens. I mean, that defense worked at the first instance, but there was a reversal on the Court of Appeal. But the reason that you're seeing the ISPs take it down is that they are under a lot of pressure from the primarily the content providers, music and movie industry, who wants to shut them down.
Yeah,
they want to shut down the big ISPs so that their stuff is not pirated.
Yeah, yeah, which I mean, and I can understand. You know, the legal cost of defending oneself, especially for some of these large organizations, which are surely being beset on all sides almost all the time, has got to be tremendous. And taking that path of least resistance and least cost is.
But they also march into court and they say, you know, Your Honor, look, they sent us a notice and we took it down. And that's very persuasive.
Yeah.
That's very persuasive. And the judge says, yes, they took it. I mean, look, that's what happened with the eBay case. That's exactly what happened with the eBay case, because Tiffany said, listen, 75% of our stuff is counterfeit on eBay. They should be shut down. And eBay said, we've got a very robust notice takedown program called the Vero program. Here, you know, Your Honor, they send us a notice that this item is counterfeit. We take it down.
Yep.
Now, I totally agree with you. The DMCA actually has set up a regime that requires notice and counter-notification, meaning that the ISP has to notify the counterparty. The owner of the product and or the owner of the website that is being requested to be shut down, allow them to respond. And I think what you're saying is that the ISPs, in their rush to defend themselves, have this evidence that may not be doing quite that.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and I guess the question really comes around to, you know, upon which party is the onus of proof, number one, but also two, who is ultimately liable for this infringement? And if the answer is the ISP, then the ISP is justified in any extent of takedown that they engage in, because ultimately they're the one that has to pay the price.
Well, the ISP is a little bit between a rock and a hard place here, because it's been held between the content providers, and by that I mean like the music and movie industry, and then it's users. Because at the end of the day, its business model depends on, the ISP business model depends on how many people come to their websites, their users.
Exactly.
So, they have come down on the side of, you know, this notice and takedown, and the way that they protect themselves against lawsuits by their users is that contractually, in their terms and conditions, and by the way, I have a lot of this in the book, you know, in terms of actually reading terms and conditions when you go and use the website, it's very important. What the ISPs have done to protect themselves against user lawsuits is to say, listen, we have discretion to take down your website. You know, contractually, there's nothing you can do.
Yeah.
You know, if we can take down your website, and if you go on all the websites, you know, you look at the Facebooks, you can YouTube, you can look at eBay, they're allowed to do that.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. I guess that it's difficult. Alexander, I apologize, but this is such a fascinating conversation, and I'm going to have to pull us to a close here. There's so much more in the book. The one area that I wanted to touch on, and we're not going to get a chance, was about ownership of data, which is just a fascinating topic and discussion. And you mentioned the Red Book, which had done copyright protection on the ownership of car values, you know, and things like this, work for hire, non-disclosure agreements, there's just a wealth of information within the book. Where can people go to find more about you, or to purchase the book, or to get more information about what you've done here?
They can go to my website, my book website, actually, which is www.montaguelaw.com/book. And Montague does not have an E at the end.
So it's so M-O...
That's very important to notice that it's MONTAGUELAW/book.
Excellent. Montaguelaw/book is a great place to start. I highly recommend the book. And whether you're directly involved with intellectual property things, you probably don't even realize how directly involved, if you're in business at all, with intellectual property and the needs and the things that are going on in the world with it today. Alexander, it was such a pleasure having you on today. I really appreciated your time, and I think that we provided a lot of fantastic information to our listeners.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. It was great being with you today.
Thank you. And I will drop you a line and let you know when the podcast is available, too. Thanks so much. Have a great weekend.
Thank you. And you.
Thank you. That was Alexander Montague. Again, that website is Montague Law, MONTAGUELAW/book. And what a great conversation. I am not lying when I tell you I had queued up probably 10 other topics that I had just pulled from the pages of this book that I was interested in talking to him about. And as you can see, there's just so much depth on any individual ones. Man, we definitely do not have time today for what I was going to pull up as going to be our cool sites of the week. So we're going to miss that. However, what I would like to do, though, I've got I do have a song that I would like to play for you. Now, this is as I said, we're kind of post-election here right now. You know, we had the elections. When was that? Oh, yeah, that's right. Tuesday. and people are still talking about it online and on Facebook. And for anybody that is still talking about this election online, I want you to listen very, very closely to this next song for you. It's by Liam Lynch. You may not have heard it for a while. Thank you so much. Shouts out to Jake Garman. Shouts out to Alexander Montague. You've been listening to Tech Talk on WRLR 98.3 LPFM in Round Lake Heights, Illinois, and we'll be back at you next week. Thanks for listening.
Whatever. I went down to the beach and saw Kiki. She was all like, and I'm like, whatever. Then this chick comes up to me and she's all like, hey, aren't you that dude? And I'm like, yeah, whatever. So later, I'm at the pool hall, and this girl comes up, and she's all like, and I'm like, yeah, whatever. Cause this is my United States of whatever. And this is my United States of whatever. And this is my United States of whatever. And then it's 3 a.m., I'm on the corner wearing my leather. This dude comes up and he's like, hey, punk. I'm like, yeah, whatever. Then I'm throwing dice in the alley. Officer Leroy comes up and he's like, hey, I thought I told you. And I'm like, yeah, whatever. Then up comes Zappo. I'm like, yo, Zappo, what's up? He's like, done. I'm like, that's cool. Cause this is not-